We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. We make choices day in and day out. Choosing not to choose is a choice, so is delaying a choice. Choices are part of everyday life. While we make choices every day, some are extraordinary, affecting not only our lives but the lives of others and our lives in community with one another. This afternoon, we're going to talk about how we choose. Our guest is social psychologist Sheena Iyengar. She began thinking about the power of choice when she was a girl. As the daughter of immigrants, she realized it is the lingua franca of America. Choice is the subject of her book, The Art of Choosing. She says, choosing helps us create our lives. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us by phone or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Sheena Iyengar is professor of business at Columbia University. Her work is often cited in the news media and in books, including Blink and The Paradox of Choice. Her book, The Art of Choosing, is published by 12 Books. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Sheena Iyengar, welcome. How are you?
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. And you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. This is a wonderful topic. You chose, by the way, some words from the poet Archibald MacLeish on freedom to lead into the book's first chapter. I don't know if you have if you would be able to share that with you, share that with us or not.
Freedom is the right to choose, the right to create for oneself, the alternatives of choice. Without the possibility of choice and the exercise of choice, a man is not a man, but a member, an instrument, a thing.
Yeah, that speaks to the importance and the power of choice, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And when we turn the page, you introduce us to a sailor. His name, Stephen Callahan. Who is he?
He's a guy that got lost at sea for over 70 days at one point in his life, and he nearly died, and he had nothing in terms of his boat. He had no way of getting anywhere. He just had to rely on his own abilities, his own resources, his hands, had to figure out how he was going to get food and how he was going to survive, and he survived over 70 days before he was finally sighted and saved. And he talks about his experiences in his autobiography and talks about how what really kept him going during those miserable times when he really didn't know whether he was going to live or die was that he had chosen to choose. He chose that he would live.
Hmm. One has to wonder, if I'd been in such a situation, would I have made it? You note that he is one of a very few people who have lasted more than a month at sea on his own. How dependent was his survival on his choice to, in his words, kick as long as I can?
You know, it's a great question because we all wonder what would we do in that circumstance, and we all wonder whether believing in my will can actually make the difference between life and death. And, you know, we'll never really know the answer to that question as to how much and at what point does it really help. But we do know that It can help at least a little, you know. I mean, you need some help from circumstance, some help from other events or external environment. But, for example, if you look at elderly patients in a nursing home and you give them the feeling that they have choice over their lives, they do tend to live a little longer. They tend to be healthier. Cancer victims, it's very controversial research, but there is some research that suggests that women with breast cancers, if they believe they have control over their disease, they might live an average of 6 months longer. Same thing is true for people with HIV. So there's certainly reason to believe that it can make some difference. Whether it makes all the difference in the world, well, it's an open question.
Mm. Did Callahan write at all about the stress he was under?
Yes, he wrote. He was under a lot of stress every day, figuring out how it was he was going to survive. And clearly, he was better prepared than certainly I, and perhaps even most people, to be able to figure out how to survive. He certainly had more skill sets than most of us to figure out how to catch fish with your hands and actually figure out how to convert that into food that would enable you to live. So he did have skill sets that enabled him, that he talks about in his book, that enabled him to live through it.
Yeah, because I have to believe that stress affects our ability to make choices.
Oh, absolutely. If we're under a lot of stress, it becomes much harder to make good choices.
Can you choose not to be stressed?
Yes, and I think that's why you see a continued interest in things like yoga and meditation and programs like The Art of Living. They're all designed in one way or another to help us become more calm, to become less stressed out with all the things that are happening in our lives, because our lives are becoming much more stressed. I mean, we have a lot more things to think about, a lot more things to choose, a lot more things we're trying to balance in our everyday lives.
Choice is powerful in part because it offers us control. In other words, I have a say here, right?
Choice is the only tool we have that enables us to go from who we are today to whom we want to be tomorrow. So it is the most powerful tool in our lives. And yet, at the same time, that tool, for the very reason that it's powerful, it's also, burdensome and stressful, because if you know that you have a say in what your tomorrow is going to look like, that means you better choose well, and that's an enormous burden and responsibility.
Hmm. How powerful is the perception of control?
The perception of control appears to be very powerful. There was a study done with rats a long time ago, and this might be a bit horrifying to many people to read about this experiment and know about this experiment, because certainly it isn't the kind of experiment that we would condone doing today. But it does reveal very compellingly the power of the perception of control. So it was a study done with rats way back in the 1950s where they took these rats and they put them in a big jar filled with water, and as they were in these jars, water was rushing onto them from the top as well. And in order to survive, they literally had to keep swimming. Now, in one case, they put the rats in and they just watched to see how long would they swim before they died. They found that on average, they swam for about 15 minutes, at which point they collapsed. In another case, what they did was they took a different set of rats, they put them in for about a minute, then they took them out. They cleaned them off, they let them wriggle around, get a sense of freedom. Then they put them back in. And now again they looked, how long would these rats swim before they gave up and died? Now they found that they swam for an average of 60 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's quite horrific when you think about the fact that, my God, they showed such will, such faith, and it was all for naught. But on the other hand, it's truly remarkable. I mean, simply having that feeling that, yes, there is some light at the end of the tunnel kept them going for that much longer.
I have a chance. I have a choice here.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say anything about how choice differs between humans and other animals?
Well, it seems very clear that, like animals, we share an instinct, a desire to have choice, a desire to be in control. So, and the way we get at that is if you take babies, you know, our babies, when they're born, instantly show a desire for control. Like if you take a newly born infant and you give them a music mobile and in one case you have the music mobile work on its own automatically, in another case you put the music mobile there, and any time that the baby's hand or toe accidentally touches it, that's when it turns on. Kids absolutely love it. They love that sense of control.
Mm.
And if you give a child the option of one box that has one cool thing in it versus two boxes that, again, has only one thing in it, but it has two slots, whether it be a baby or whether it be a rat or whether it be a pigeon or whether it be a monkey, everybody goes for the two boxes, even though it only has one treasure in it, as opposed to the one box that has one treasure in it.
Mm-hmm.
So we all want choice. We all want that desire for control. And both babies and animals suffer when basic control is taken away.
When do we realize what we're doing is choosing?
That comes much later. And it's hard to say if animals realize when they're choosing, right? I mean, that's an open question.
Mm.
But with humans, I definitely, by the age of two, they recognize and have an understanding of basic preferences. You know, the first words out of any kid's mouth, the world over, it's usually some form of yes or no. My son's first word was more. You know, which was at once an expression of both preference and choice. So,
what a wonderful first word.
It wasn't mama. I tried really hard.
Yeah. But more means mom's doing good things because I want more.
Yeah.
Right? So you got that. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about choice. Our guest is Sheena Iyengar. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. In my introduction, I took note that you had described choice as the lingua franca of America, yet choosing is something people everywhere do. Are there differences across cultures?
There are differences across cultures. So we're all born with a desire for control over our lives, but how we believe that control should be practiced and who should make the choices and how choices should be made, that's something we're all culturally trained. We're socialized into having particular ideas about how choices are made.
Does the amount, the degree of choice vary in environments from one country to another?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it varies as a function of the economics. It varies as a function of the political dynamics of the country. It varies as a function of whatever the social dynamics are in that culture. Sure. I mean, the United States is particularly unique in that, you know, it was the first country that was really founded on the ideas of political freedom and economic freedom at the time. And then later on in the 1800s, we added this idea of self-reliance and individual freedom, the idea that you can be whoever you want to be, free of any social constraints or social norms. That's a very unique package even today. I mean, it's rare to have all three of those come together in such an extreme form as it does in the United States.
Let's take a call. We've got a listener waiting for us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. On this topic of choice and the neuroscience behind it.
Uh-huh. Hi.
Are you familiar with studies using functional MRI where the subjects were scanned and areas of the brain were identified that had to do with choosing and choice?
I'm familiar with many MRI studies. I'm not sure which one in particular you're referring to.
The one I'm talking about is it seemed to the investigators that the areas involved in choice would light up on the functional MRI scan before the subjects were able to consciously be aware that they had made the choice. In other words, the choice was already made, and then they hit the button and said, now I've decided, but the investigators could already see on functional MRI.
Yes, yes.
That the choices were made. So in other words, do we really have free will, or is it just an illusion, you know, that we're deciding? You know, is it something that subconsciously in other centers of the brain has already decided, and then we rationalize that with our conscious mind afterwards, or do we really have choice? That's my question.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I actually grappled with that question for quite some time when I was working on one of the chapters in my book where I talk about all these subconscious priming and how so many of our preferences are not only decided before we're consciously aware of them, but how so much marketing actually manipulates us into wanting what we want. You know, like there's a large amount of marketing that went into why we actually prefer Coke most of the time over Pepsi and why we love McDonald's, et cetera. I think we do have free will. Are we manipulated a good portion of our life? Absolutely. And we're not just manipulated by the people hired to manipulate us, like marketers. We're manipulated all the time, subconsciously, consciously. We're influenced by our parents. We're influenced by our friends. We're influenced by our environment where we live. Every single thing we encounter throughout our life is influencing us in some way. So that means that we're not entirely independent agents. But does that mean we have no free will? Well, I don't think that the answer to that is that we don't have free will, because if there was no free will, we would have no ability to change things. And there's many times, both in our lives as individuals as well as our lives as a society, in which people have come together and said, I will make a change. So, and that, you know, certainly the most violent period of that in our nation's history was when we very consciously made a choice to say, let us end slavery, even though we had presumably learned to live with a, quote, way of life. So we did exercise free will and paid a heavy cost for it. And I think what it boils down to is because we're being influenced all the time, we have to take on that responsibility, each of us as individuals, to identify what is it that's really important to us. And those have to be a small number, 3, 4, 5, and certainly not more than 5. And once you understand what your priorities are, then you can become more cognizant of what are the influences or the potential influences of why you might want what you want or think the way you think. And once you're able to unravel what those elements are that's affecting your decision, you now have the ability to veto an influence. And it's with that veto power that you can exercise free will.
Does the listener want to follow up?
Well, I remain unconvinced because, you know, on a biochemical level, really, you know, our neurons and all our functioning, the proteins and the neurotransmitters and all such are ultimately derived from DNA templates, and we're not capable of making any choices that reach beyond that ultimately. So I think it's just all an illusion. I think the is, you know, spinning a lot of smoke and mirrors. And the truth is, we have very little free will. There's very little we can do to change our basic nature, and I hear a lot of human stories of personal transformation, but they're wildly spun and exaggerated. I don't think humans are, you know, particularly adults, are very capable of much change at all. Perhaps incremental, gradual, slow, painstaking, after perseverance, they can change somewhat. But I don't buy the guest's theories here. Thanks.
Thanks for the comment. And I think I'm going to ask our guest to talk about the influence of stories in our lives.
In what way? What are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of in the stories that we tell one another, the stories that we have about ourselves, what role do they have in our beliefs about choice?
Well, I think whenever I ask you, you know, tell me why you're doing the career that you're doing or why you married or fell in love with whom you fell in love with, we all have a tendency to tell the story in one of three ways. We either tell the story in terms of destiny, you know, I was destined to do this and there's nothing I could have done to prevent it, or we tell the story in terms of chance, a set of random events that happened to, or luck that happened to land me in this place at this moment and I met this person, or I happened to come across this person and they gave me this great chance to do this job. Or we tell the story of what happened to us in terms of choice. I came across, I decided that I wanted to find someone and went about going to this place and happened to find this person. Or I decided I wanted to do this particular career and here's the process I went through. All of these descriptions of the story of our life are just as accurate. No one can say which one is more or less true. But I do think there are consequences to which one you choose to use when telling the story of your life. And when you tell the story of your life in terms of choice, that's really the only one that gives you the power to make change in your life, to go from who you are today to whom you want to be tomorrow.
At the close of your book, you say, choosing helps us create our lives. And before you say that, you tell the story of Sisyphus.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us the story and tell us why you included Sisyphus at the close of The Art of Choosing.
You know, most people, when they hear the story of Sisyphus, they consider it a very depressing story, right? I mean, here's this guy condemned to hell, and he's condemned to having to roll the rock up the hill, and then it comes down. And so then he rolls it again. And it's this endless rolling of the rock. And everybody knows that it'll never work out the way Sisyphus wants, because this is what he's been condemned to. But, you know, it's like the rats. If he caves into that, then what's left? So that at that moment, when he looks back and sees that the rock has gone back down, he can decide to quit. But he chooses not to. He chooses to go back down and do it again. Because although choice always has a certain futility to it, a bit of uncertainty to it, you never know whether it'll give you what you want. But it's only when you choose that you actually can expect and hope for a tomorrow. I mean, and I think therein lies its mystery, its power, and its singular beauty.
Yeah. It's key to our survival.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking today about how we choose. Our guest is social psychologist Sheena Iyengar. She began thinking about the power of choice when she was a girl. Maybe we'll talk with her about that in a moment. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. By email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Professor of Business at Columbia University. She is the author of The Art of Choosing. So when did you really begin to think critically about choice and choosing?
As an academic?
As I mentioned, you in the early going in your book, you mentioned that this is an area that really you started to think about as a girl. And maybe it was because of, in part, because you were You were the child of immigrants, so you had a foot in two worlds, essentially, I would say.
Yeah, I really did start thinking, not in an academic sense, but I started to think about choice and all its limitations when I was a child, because I was the daughter of Sikh parents, and I was growing up in the United States. I was constantly going back and forth between two very different ideas and languages of choice, in a sense. I mean, at home, you learned the language of duty and responsibility, and you had all kinds of duties and rules that you had to live by. You know, as a Sikh, you never cut your hair, and you dressed conservatively, and you didn't talk to boys, and didn't sit next to boys, and, you know, most of our, you know, like my parents' marriage was arranged. They met each other on their wedding day, and, you know, most of the time, your careers and things like that were decided based on the wisdom and experience of the elders. By contrast, in school, I was learning about the role of personal preference, that, you know, you're supposed to decide what you're going to eat and how you're going to dress and how you're going to do your hair. And is there anything more horrific than the idea of having someone else decide whom you were going to marry and, you know, God forbid. And, you know, you should be the one who's searching for what career you're going to do for the rest of your life. And so it was this constant, you know, thinking back and forth as to which one was right. And these were two very different models about who should be doing the choosing and how important is it for personal preference. I mean, is that really the most important thing in life? And, you know, my parents would always say, you know, how can you choose? You don't know what's good. and, you know, the Americans are like, well, you're the only one that knows what's good for you. And so there were very different ideas, and I think that made me very interested in the role choice plays from a very cultural perspective, yeah. And how you're really taught to choose very differently depending on the culture in which you're raised.
In this portion of the book, you say that the effects of culture go beyond the individual's own perceptions of choice and their desire to choose. They shape the way people actually choose, which in turn impacts the society.
Oh, sure, because when you are an Asian, when you make a choice, you don't ask yourself, what do I want? You ask yourself, can I afford to want this thing or do this thing that I want? Because, you know, given how many inconveniences that it will cause, are those inconveniences worth it? Or small enough that it's okay? Whereas in American culture, you ask yourself, what is it that I want? And then you try to figure out, are there ways that I can minimize the inconvenience that it will cause to others? But the goal is still to do what you want. Mm.
Now, there are ways in which we, as Americans, allow others to make choices for us, or we act together to make choices. One example that comes to mind is we abide by the results of elections.
Mm-hmm.
Another is that we draw up legal documents to allow others of our choosing to choose for us if we're unable to choose.
Mm-hmm. What is amazing about this country is we really are, you know, on the one hand, we often bash, you know, our legal system because it allows for so many lawsuits, et cetera, and there are times when we often feel disillusioned with our legal system and its inability at times to maybe accomplish all our goals. But on the other hand, it really has played a phenomenal role in creating stability. And certainly the fact that we can go from one election to the next and have elections whose outcomes are ones that we're not always happy with. You know, like, for example, the controversial election of Bush versus Gore. On the one hand, you can point to, well, you know, we also have issues when it comes down to how we set up those voting booths. But on the other hand, it is quite remarkable what kind of a nation we are, because we were dissatisfied and we weren't quite persuaded that that was the best outcome or the, quote, right outcome. But we understood the need to follow the principles of democracy and follow the principles of how our government was set up.
And that meant that we would live with the outcome as set forth by that process.
Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just a comment or so. When she was mentioning Sisyphus,
mm-hmm.
I was reminded of the book by Albert Camus decades ago,
mm-hmm.
The Myth of Sisyphus. I'm not sure if he has a choice, maybe he does, roll the rock back up or down. But if I remember this correctly, Camus makes a point that he does have a choice on his state of mind, and one can even imagine a joyous, happy Sisyphus as he continues to roll the rock up and follow it down and back and forth. So I thought I'd just throw that in. And just ever so briefly, this is off the topic, and I apologize, but is Garrison Keillor's Writer's Almanac going to still be around with all the changes? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the call. Yes, Garrison Keillor will continue to be with us, the Writer's Almanac, in the noon hour of this program, The Afternoon Magazine. And let's call on our guest now, Sheena Iyengar, to talk about the listener's first comment.
Hi, so that's a great comment. And I do think you can interpret that what happens to Sisyphus as being that he really doesn't have any control over that rock, and the only thing he has control over is his state of mind. I think you can interpret it either way.
Yeah. Well, if you think of people who have been imprisoned, like let's say someone like Nelson Mandela,
mm-hmm.
he had the power to make choices in his confinement.
Mm-hmm. And you see similar stories being told by people like Elie Wiesel and other mm-hmm. survivors of the Holocaust.
Yeah. I want to go back to the idea of, or the question we were talking about a little bit ago about elections. There was a curious thing that happened in Illinois here in the last election. We had a primary election in February, and the ballot boxes were set up so that if you put in a ballot that left a particular race, a particular contest not filled in, the box beeped at you to say, you missed something here.
Oh, interesting. I didn't
yeah.
know about that. Mm-hmm.
And I think I wanted to ask you about this, get your thoughts about it, because it says to me maybe, you know, where we make choices that maybe we don't need to make because we're expected to make choices.
Well, this got some interesting ramifications if it beeps at you to tell you, look, you didn't make all the choices you were supposed to make. So that means that now you have to form an opinion about candidates that you perhaps haven't thought about.
Exactly. You don't know who you're voting for. So maybe maybe you think, well, I'll mark the ballot, but I don't know anything about.
I just hope they're randomizing the order in which the candidates appear, because in that case, when people are forced to have an opinion, they're probably going to just pick the one that comes first.
Yeah.
It'll be more likely that they'll do that.
Yeah. Well, I think political observers here in Illinois have wondered how well-informed or ill-informed we were when we went to the polls in February. We've already had one candidate bowing out of the general election because of some things that came to light that people didn't know about, and who knows how much we knew about who we voted for in that particular race. Well, let's talk about something else, maybe in terms of current events and choice. A major healthcare topic today involves choice, that is, making lifestyle choices, and we often don't make very good choices in this regard. Why not? Maybe you could talk with us about the experience of the automatic and reflective senses in making decisions.
You mean in terms of what we eat or what kinds of health choices?
Either one.
So, well, whenever we're thinking about should I do something good or bad, let's say, should I eat this piece of cake or not, and I know I probably shouldn't eat this piece of cake, we have two things that are helping us make our choices at any moment in time. The one is our gut, which I refer to in the book as the automatic system, but yeah, it's basically our gut. And it's telling us how we feel about it, which means that when I'm looking at that cake, I'm feeling like that's going to taste really, really good. And then there's our reason in our, or sort of our reflective system, which is telling us, you know, you really shouldn't eat that cake. It's bad for you. It's going to make you gain weight. It's going to cause you all kinds of health problems. You really should put it off and really discipline yourself and only have like one sweet a week. And we could have all the best intentions in the world, but when that cake is staring us in the face, what happens is our gut has an ability to overrule our reason. And that's because in the moment, our gut is always much more powerful. It's our emotions. It's always much more powerful than our reflective system. And really, the only way we can combat that is if we find ways to essentially get around and control our gut, you know, like don't have the cake around or have rules that really become very difficult to violate. And we shouldn't give ourselves, well, the momentary exception, you know, I'll be good today, tomorrow I won't do it. Most of the time, once you get started with that pattern, that persists. Because it's just that our gut is very strong. It's just very, very powerful in the moment. That is more powerful than our reason. So you got to create systems where you don't have the stuff there, or you have rules that you have to live by, or if you eat that cake that, I don't know, $100 at this very instant will get deducted out of your bank account and just, and given over to, you know, your hated charity. But that's really the only ways in which we can control our temptation problem.
Yeah. We have, in so many areas of our lives, we have so much choice. How does that complicate our lives in terms of making wise choices?
Well, for sure, the more desserts you're confronted by, the more you're thinking about dessert. Right? So that, and, you know, what's interesting actually, even about the food industry, is people talk about how the number of packaged foods that have gone up and the number of bad foods out there, and that's why we have the obesity problem today. Well, the truth is that it's not just the bad foods that have gone up, it's the good foods that have gone up. We actually eat a lot more vegetables as well than we ever did before. It's not just that we're eating the bad stuff, we're eating everything a lot more.
When we're confronted with, you know, I found over the years that if I'm looking to make a decision to buy a product, and it's going to be a big deal, if there's a lot of choice, it makes it really hard to make a decision. And you'd think that a lot of choice would be a good thing.
Yes. So what I find in my research is that when people have a lot of choices to choose from, even though they're initially really excited, they become paralyzed. So I started this investigation in a study in a grocery store where this is a store that actually had a lot of customers come because they offered lots and lots of choices, really one of those gourmet grocery stores. They offered like 250 different mustards and vinegars and over 500 different kinds of fruits and vegetables. And so we did a tasting booth where we either put out 6 different flavors of jam or 24 different flavors of jam. And our questions were 2, in which case are people more attracted and in which case are people more likely to buy? And what we found was that people were more likely to be attracted to the tasting booth when there were 24 different flavors of jam. About 60% of the people stopped as compared to only 40% of the people stopped when there were 6 different flavors of jam on display. But when it came down to buying, we saw the opposite. So that of the people who stopped when there were 24 flavors of jam, only 3% of them actually bought a jar of jam, whereas of the people who stopped when there were 6 different flavors of jam, 30% of them actually bought a jar of jam. So while they were initially more attracted to having more options to choose from, it seemed much more exciting, when it came down to actually choosing, they were much more able to make a choice when they chose from a few than when they had to choose from more.
Let's take another call. This listener is waiting for us in Savoy on line two. Hi.
Hello. As an election judge, I would like to clarify a misstatement that the host made concerning the ballot box rejection.
Okay. Thank you for that. Go ahead.
You're not forced to make a choice if you decided not to vote for every candidate on the ballot. You're not forced to make the choice if your ballot is rejected. It only is a notification that you omitted one. If you resubmit the same ballot, it will accept it.
That's correct. So, thank you very much for pointing that omission out on my part. Did you want to add anything else, listener? I guess not. So I stand somewhat correct. Yes, you could make the decision. You could say to the election judge, I realize what I have done. Go ahead and have my ballot counted as I have marked it.
What's interesting, though, about that reminder is that it does prime you to feel as if you should have an opinion.
And now I've got a couple of questions someone has submitted by email. A listener in Urbana asks, could it be true that we are offered numerous trivial choices in some matters, but few fundamental formative choices about how to live our lives? That's the first question.
I do think that we have a lot of choices when it comes down to, you know, cereal and toothpaste and, you know, what we're going to look like on Second Life and, you know, even maybe how we construct our faces and our general physical aesthetics, et cetera. So we have a lot of choices for those sorts of things. And there are still domains in our life in which people don't feel like they have some real choices. You know, take, for example, women and the choice of whether or not to have a child versus have a career. I think many women will say that they don't feel that they have the same choices as do men, because when they choose to have a child, they have to weigh child rearing against their career. And they don't feel that they're as able to have both in the same way as they feel that men can. It's interesting to think about that. Is there something we can do differently so that women can feel that the choice of having a child doesn't come with the cost of their careers?
And here's the second question. Do people sometimes want to be relieved of the responsibility of choosing for themselves, wanting to be told what to think, say, and do by some authority, but are reluctant to admit that?
Oh, I think so. I mean, we actually have been doing a lot of studies now with people that have been faced with some very difficult decisions to make when it comes down to their health. For example, in one study, we looked at parents that had dying infants, and we compared French and American parents. And in France, you know, if your child is in a vegetative state, the doctor decides when and if to pull the plug. In the United States, the parents have to make that decision. They have to sign the consent form taking the child off the life support. And when you follow these parents after the death of their child up to a year later, you find that, you know, the French parents were really better able to cope with the loss of their child. They didn't carry around this guilt. You know, they were much more likely to move on. You know, they were more likely to say things like, you know, Noah was here for so little time, but I learned so much from him in the little time he was here. He gave us a new perspective on life. Whereas the Americans were much more likely to say, even a year later, you know, I keep thinking to myself, what if, as it was as if I played a role in an execution. And, you know, this is a case where, you know, they're almost feeling trapped by the choice.
Yeah, It's such a burdensome thing to do, to have to be confronted with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's squeeze in one more call. Listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello. Speaking of trapped, I want to return to the caller who talked about determinism, free will. You talked about cake and gut, not having it around. How do you get the idea that you will discipline your gut or not discipline your gut? Do you come down to saying, I am trapped because my mother or my wife or somebody keeps putting cake in the house? I can't control it. And if it's here, I'm going to eat it.
That's why I made that comment about how our best ability to exercise free will does not come from the ability to decide what influences will appear in our context. It comes from our ability to, after knowing our priorities, veto an influence. It's really more veto power, so that once you have consciously come to the idea that, you know, this cake, it's hurting me, we do have the power to veto its existence in our life.
The power of choice. We have to wrap it up here. Sheena Iyengar, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me on here today.
You're very welcome. Choice is the subject of our guest's book, The Art of Choosing. The book is published by 12 Books.